You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, I'm Mike Pesca, in for Leonard Lopate. It is the first variant of American conservatism in the past century that is in the American grain. It is hopeful, not lugubrious, forward-looking, not nostalgic, and its general tone is cheerful, not grim or dyspeptic. What is this concept that its most prominent early adherent is writing about? Neoconservatism. Author Irving Kristol there, his son Bill Kristol took neoconservatism in a new direction. And Matthew Duss says neoconservatism has taken us all for a ride. Matthew Duss is the national security editor for the blog's Think Tank and the Wonk Room at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. His recent article for The Nation magazine is Attack of the Cheneys. It questions the latest incarnations of the American-based neoconservative movement. Hey, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. So before we get to the big picture analysis of the movement, let's talk about a recent specific. Dick Cheney and his daughter Liz Cheney were attacking defense lawyers of Guantanamo detainees. What was the substance of their criticism?
Well, there was really very little substance, but the attack was just, you know, quote unquote, raising questions about lawyers who were now working for the Department of Justice who had in the past worked pro bono for detainees in Guantanamo Bay, challenging the basis for their detention.
And as much as you describe that sort of thing as the same old slander, sometimes not even in new dressing, for some reason, this caused a big problem. And even among their fellow conservatives, people thought this was out of bounds. Why is that?
Right. Well, I mean, it does say a lot about how far over the line they went, that people like Ken Starr had come out against these attacks. People like Ted Olson, who was the Bush administration's solicitor general, called these attacks over the line, because they were basically attacking and implying very, very strongly that these people who worked pro bono on behalf of some of these detainees had terrorist sympathies.
Was it the sort of thing that... It seems like a misstep. You talk about Ted Olson and others of his ilk who, well, Ted Olson is recently now defending gay rights, so perhaps he's split with other aspects of the conservative movement. But they criticized it, so perhaps an observer would say, oh, so their new group has misstepped. But within the group, do they think that even the kerfuffle lionizes their base? Are they pleased, do you think, with how that all turned out?
Well, no, I think that is, they've got to be happy just about all the noise that it made, because, I mean, this is one of the things I talk about in my article, is that there's really no accountability for Liz Cheney and Bill Kristol who are making these attacks. They just kind of launched these attacks at people, and in a case like this where you have this serious pushback, they just kind of slink back into the weeds and develop another attack. And the real purpose is to just kind of cultivate fear and make a lot of noise and put people on the defensive, but there's really no substantive analysis coming here. It is all based on, you know, creating a better political environment for Republicans and conservatives simply by drumming up a lot of fear.
Their group, Keep America Safe, how recently was that formed?
This was last fall that this organization started.
And do you think, within their own definition of what their mission is, do you think they think they're successful or that they're having success?
Well, I do think that, you know, just, you know, the fact that we are talking about them now, the fact that a lot of other people, you know, there have been a lot of stories written about this. I mean, how extreme some of these charges are. So simply on the basis of coverage, I would say they have to be happy with that.
Well, I don't even mean in terms of coverage. I'm sure people would rather be known than unknown. But is it the sort of thing where, you know, polite society or whatever you want to call the conventional wisdom is appalled at least one of the complaints they were making, but secretly, because of that very complaint, and money is pouring in and their power is growing?
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's really what's happening. As much as, you know, some people have really been shocked at some of these ideas, they are continuing to attract funding. They are continuing to attract support and movement in Congress on some of these issues relating to detainee policy, relating to the quote-unquote war on terror. So, yes.
Other than the fact that you disagree with their assessment of if America is safe or not, do you question the very, not premise of what they're doing, but the honesty of what they're doing? Do you think that they're saying we should keep America safe not because they think it's a safety issue, but they have some other agenda?
Well, I think on one level, I think there's two things here. I mean, according to some of the people I spoke to, like Steve Clemens of the New America Foundation, his view is that, someone like Bill Kristol is really kind of preoccupied But I think this goes for Liz Cheney, too, with preoccupied with kind of protecting and securing their own role as you know, a power broker in the conservative movement. So there's that. On the other hand, I think, you know, someone like Dick Cheney, I give him credit. I think he really does believe a lot of what he's saying. He's made, you know, it's been really out of the ordinary for a former vice president to be as visible as he has been, because he really believes in these policies. But at the same time, I think when you look at the policies that we're talking about and the way, I mean, we rarely ever get in social science an ability to test policies as explicitly as we were able to test some of these ideas and theories after 9/11, and they just conclusively failed. So I think that's, when I talk about the problem of accountability, I think that people haven't been forward enough in pushing back on some of these claims, because, you know, we went into this war on terror. There were these claims made about how we needed to go into the Middle East and transform the Middle East and topple Saddam and how it would have all these good effects. And none of these good effects have come to pass, very much the opposite. So I think it is not only a problem of these people, it's a problem of the media and a problem of the foreign policy establishment to point these things out and hold these people accountable.
So if Dick Cheney is more of a true believer and his daughter Liz Cheney perhaps more of an opportunist, I know you quote Barton Gellman in your piece, and he's the author of the book Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. He thinks that Liz is the one who's pushing Dick Cheney to be more vocal. In fact, he says that without Liz Cheney, Dick Cheney might not even be writing his memoirs.
Right. That's, I heard from Gellman, and I've heard from some others. I mean, that's the general understanding, is that, you know, Dick is, as he showed when he was vice president, as during that famous interview when he was asked about, you know, the fact that American people don't support the Iraq war anymore, he just responded, well, so, you know, as if that really, he just doesn't care. I mean, he's really someone who just does what he does and really doesn't care what people think. So, yeah, it seems pretty clear that Liz is the one, you know, both in terms of protecting his legacy, protecting the policies that he pushed for, and also securing her own political future. She feels that he needs to be out there defending those ideas and writing this memoir as a part of that, too.
And as far as that answer, so, I mean, there is something on a level to be admired there. I mean, as you've been hearing, I mean, take healthcare, the most recent debate. If someone, that's how usually the question is asked, well, you're in favor of healthcare, and you said why, but the polls show the American people don't like it, and usually an answer some long-winded, well, they'll get to know it. What if a politician just said, so? It's the right thing to do, so?
Right, that is a particular way of going about politics. I mean, going back to Edmund Burke, who, you know, he was elected to the parliament, and he made clear that he had been elected and he was going to go ahead and do whatever he wanted, and if you didn't like the way he did things, you could just vote him out next time.
Right.
There's another view that says, well, if you're elected, you have to act on the basis of your own best knowledge, but at the same time, you do need to stay in contact with your constituents, and you want to cultivate support among the population for these ideas. You don't just kind of dismiss them, as Cheney did.
Do you know, now, a lot of what you write, as apart from Attack of the Cheneys, you kind of diagnose the neoconservative movement. You know, it's a movement that the people who are in the movement, I quoted Irving Kristol, and that was 20, 30 years ago. But the current incarnation, you know, Bill Kristol always laughs when someone uses the term neoconservative. He says, I don't really even know what that is. And many of them have only begun to identify themselves as such because, you know, they're tired of fighting the label. So is it really a coherent movement? Can you point to, here are the six things we believe if the people who are neoconservatives deny its existence?
Well, right. Going back to Irving Kristol and the first generation of neoconservatives, Daniel Bell, Nathan Glaser, Nathan Howe, Irving Howe, excuse me. You know, these are people who genuinely made a transition from the left to the right and hence earned that term neoconservative. I mean, their ideas were much more focused on domestic policy and American culture and American nationalism. And it's in the 90s, as I write, with Robert Kagan and Bill Kristol's article Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy, that those two kind of elucidate a modern foreign policy neoconservatism, and that is what neoconservatism has come to be about now, foreign policy primarily. Now, as far as what they all believe, it's a very, very overt hegemony. You know, it's a belief in the benevolent hegemony of the United States, the idea of the United States as the preeminent power in the world should be able to go about the world unbound by kind of rules and multilateral institutions, just to really enforce our will and change reality, as it were, whenever we want, anywhere around the world, with very little acknowledgement that there are serious costs, consequences, and trade-offs to some of these policies.
Yeah, sort of turning Clausewitz on his head, that war is diplomacy by another means. But What about the idea, and we've been mentioning it, but we haven't talked explicitly about it, Bill Kristol, Liz Cheney, they're the children of prominent, maybe more pure believers in the neoconservative movement. What's going on there, either psychologically or via family dynamics?
Right. I think, you know, they, as you said, they're both kind of scions of these conservative families. They're very well connected. They were sort of born into these powerful networks. And with the two of them merging or working much closely together, I think we see, you know, this one faction of neoconservatives represented by Bill Kristol and then the Cheney network, which is very formidable. I mean, he's someone who's been in conservative politics for about four decades. So he's has a very formidable network of fundraisers and power brokers that are connected to him and now to Liz. So it's just looking at the, you know, their attempt to maintain control of the commanding heights of the conservative foreign policy establishment, and they're having a lot of success doing that.
This is Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm speaking with Matthew Duss, who's the national security editor for Think Tank and The Wonk Room, two prominent blogs. You know, there was a time, it's a little bit odd to talk about the neoconservative movement because, especially at the time where we first went to war in Iraq, neoconservative movement was almost every Republican in the Senate and the House of Representatives. I mean, only one Republican, Lincoln Chafee, as a senator, voted against the resolution. Six members of the House, including Ron Paul. So there was a time when to be a conservative, it seemed, was to be a neoconservative. Has that lessened?
I don't think so. I think there used to be different. There used to be when neoconservatives first moved over to the Republican Party, starting in the Nixon era, but really, you know, fully in the Reagan era, there was still this realist strain of Republicanism that we'd associate now with someone like Brent Scowcroft. Colin Powell, I think, fell under this heading. But more and more, and certainly it's still the case now, the neoconservatives have really managed to take control of the reins of conservative foreign policy.
Well, not only Scowcroft and Powell and guys who were maybe more moderate, but there was the, you know, Pat Buchanan would always call himself a paleoconservative who
right.
just didn't think that war could, that the United States, he was more of an isolationist. That
right.
wing of the party, I don't know, maybe they could be found in the Tea Parties, but that hasn't been talked about for quite some time.
Right, and I do cover this in the article, too, is if you look at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, if you look at that straw poll, Ron Paul won that straw poll with one of the highest totals in the conference's history. So there's still, as far as the grassroots are concerned, this sort of more isolationist, less excited about all kinds of foreign adventures, I mean, it's still there among the grassroots, but as far as conservative elites are concerned, there's really no close competitor toward the neoconservative ideology.
And maybe part of that is that when national security is the number one issue, neoconservatism becomes the kind of conservatism of the day. But now that everyone's talking about health care and domestic policies, the neoconservatives don't have as much to say about that.
Well, I think Kristol himself, I mean, he really battled health care a lot. He made very, I mean, if we think back to, you know, the Clinton era, his famous memo, where he just called for conservatives to just oppose outright health care, just beat it.
Right.
I mean, he
as
tried
a tactic,
to re-enliven
yes.
that. So he's definitely taken a hit with health care having passed. So they remain interested in domestic policy. But I think there's still genuine debate among conservatives about these issues, whereas in foreign policy, the neoconservatives are pretty much preeminent.
I'm speaking with Matthew Duss, national security editor for the blogs Think Progress and The Wonk Room. We're talking, among other things, about his article, Attack of the Cheneys. It's in the April 5th edition of The Nation, and we'll be back with more after a break. Hi, I'm Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Matthew Duss, national security editor for Think Progress in the Wonk Room, and he's dissecting the neoconservative movement. So, Matthew, where do the Tea Parties fit in with the neoconservative movement, or do they?
Well, there's been a little bit of controversy about this. I think Ron Paul himself, who, you know, the Tea Party started as a movement based around Ron Paul and his primary candidacy, you know, very, very strong fiscal conservatism, right, a more isolationist stance in foreign policy. And he's been very, very, he's made a number of comments that are very suspicious of what he sees as the neoconservatives trying to infiltrate or build, you know, connections with this grassroots movement and take it over. I mean, specifically in regard to Sarah Palin speaking at a number of Tea Party events. I mean, Sarah Palin, who, if you remember, she was, you know, first identified by Bill Kristol as a future Republican star. It was Kristol's influence that got her onto the McCain campaign, and he's continued to champion her even after they lost to Barack Obama. So, and I also should point out, as I note in the article, that she has being staffed and advised right now by Randy Schuneman, who is a close friend of Kristol, and so Schuneman is advising her on foreign policy. Also working for Schuneman's advising firm is Mike Goldfarb, who formerly worked for Kristol at the Weekly Standard and now also works for Keep America Safe. So, I mean, there's all these connections here. They're all kind of part of the same neoconservative faction. But I see them using Sarah Palin as a way to kind of manage the base here and kind of manage the Tea Party as best they can.
Kristol has a little bit of a history about taking these empty vessels. I'm sure the people would object to that, but, you know, he was Dan Quayle's chief of staff, and Dan Quayle had, if you read the memos of what Kristol said about Quayle and Palin, a lot of it were, you know, how they were attractive, physically attractive people who were youthful and energetic and maybe didn't have their own fully formed ideas and would be able to listen to his ideas about what to do in policy and foreign policy.
Right. I think that's probably unfair to Dan Quayle, though.
Really? And then as far as, you know, and then if the question is, so is John McCain, is he a neoconservative? Where does he fit in with the Tea Parties? Sarah Palin yesterday, while stumping with McCain, you know, in her inimitable syntax, said something like, we're all in the Tea Party. So they all got sucked into it.
Right, and you could see McCain's really, really uncomfortable grin there when she was saying that. I mean, he seemed extremely uncomfortable having to be up there with her in the first place. But, I mean, he's a star, and he has to do what he has to do to win.
So you mentioned Ron Paul a couple times. What's your assessment of him? I mean, he stands in opposition to these neoconservatives who you don't like, but is there something to be – do you consider him a more honorable actor, you know, as far as all these questions go?
I don't know if I would say honorable. I mean, I understand he is coming from a very traditional American isolationist strain of conservatism. I certainly take him at his word. I'm not particularly sympathetic to his views, but I just do find it interesting that he does have this movement around him that are very enthusiastic, but he's really not been able to cultivate the elite support, or more to the point, there hasn't been a lot of money that has flowed to these ideas that he's talking about to create a more significant policy challenge to the neoconservatives.
If the name of the organization is Keep America Safe and the constant refrain is we're less safe now than when the Bush-Cheney administration was in place, what do they cite? Whether you agree with it or not, what are the tangibles that they could cite that have been policy changes that have made America less safe?
Well, one of the main ones is the announcement that we were going to stay within the Army Field Manual in terms of interrogations, that we were explicitly not going to use torture anymore. They don't call it torture; they call it enhanced interrogation. So, yeah, I mean, these are things that the Bush administration had stopped doing toward the last year of its administration. I mean, this is what's really interesting is a lot of things they talk about. I mean, Bush himself had said he wanted to close Guantanamo. John McCain has said he wants to close Guantanamo. There seems to be a very strong recognition among, you know, big parts of the foreign policy establishment that a lot of these ideas, the use of torture, indefinite detention in Guantanamo, certainly the invasion of Iraq, the war of civilizations rhetoric that really characterized the Bush administration in the years immediately after 9/11, that these were very, very destructive of actual American security.
Right. This is one of the reasons why I asked what changed, because, as you mentioned, they got away from waterboarding and they announced their intention to close Guantanamo, which hasn't been closed. And the Obama administration was heavily criticized for how it handled the detention of the underwear bomber, the Christmas Day bomber. But that was exactly how the U.S. government handled the detention of Reed. So I wonder if there's you know, anything, even if you say that they're wrong on policy, if there's anything real that really has been a big change from Obama for, or from Bush to Obama.
Well, I think it's less a change from Bush, from the, you know, Bush, even toward the end of his presidency, as I said, had really changed and left some of these policies behind that Cheney had championed. So that's what they're really talking about. Some of these ideas about, you know, keeping Guantanamo open, about using enhanced interrogation. But moreover, it is, I think it's less a substantive thing, and it is really more an attitude, just this idea that we are at war and you need to behave as if we're at war, which it means saying we're at war all the time, as far as I can figure. But more than that, just constantly cultivating this idea of a war president and a country at war.
We're on a war footing.
Yeah, on a war footing, yes. That first of all, this just creates better political ground for conservatives. And they've been very explicit about this, even going back to Crystal and Kagan's piece in the 90s, which was pitched as a manifesto for conservative political success, just saying an America that a robust and militaristic American foreign policy is a foreign policy that conservatives can run and win on.
President Obama has had his own stumbles, and maybe you think they're just PR stumbles on the question of security. He had to sort of walk back some remarks that Homeland Security Chief Janet Napolitano made after the detention of the Detroit bomber. And, of course, there is the whole issue of the trials that were to be and now are not to be held in New York City. Your assessment of his policies in terms of security and then the optics surrounding his policies?
Well, I do. I certainly appreciate some of the statements that he's made and the understanding that he seems to have about changing the perception of the way the United States is going about its national security. He seems that President Obama really understands that rhetoric matters, and this has a real demonstrable impact on our security. I think there are certain things that I'm less comfortable with. I'm hoping that he will not give in to putting KSM in a military tribunal. That seems like that's eventually going to happen. That seems to have been handled very, very poorly. But I think it really does come down to this basic question, this posture of America at war. What does this really mean? When we talk about being at war with Al-Qaeda, I think the among policy analysts and military and intelligence, the general opinion, as far as I can gauge it, is that when we treat Al-Qaeda as soldiers, we affirm their own status. We affirm their propaganda, and that's just not good for us. But that, ironically, that is essentially what the Cheneys and the Crystals are doing here when they talk about, you know, this war against Al-Qaeda and this war on terror.
Well, both sides use the argument, you know, don't do this policy. It's exactly what Al-Qaeda wants. And sometimes Al-Qaeda, you know, they've said it about the military tribunals. One side says, if you treat them as soldiers, it's exactly what Al-Qaeda wants. And the other one says, if you change your mind on it, it shows America is weak, and it's exactly what Al-Qaeda wants. If you give them a civilian trial, it's exactly what Al-Qaeda wants. Maybe we'd all be better off to say Al-Qaeda may or may want something, but we have to do the policies that are best for this country, not just simply the opposite of what Al-Qaeda, quote unquote, wants.
Right. I totally agree with that. But I think there is something to be said for, you know, the consensus. And again, I mean, this is just something I've gathered. When we're talking about, as we've understood over the last few years, you know, the public messaging, to the extent that we are involved in, you know, a global effort to delegitimize Al-Qaeda and delegitimize the strain of extremism that they represent, the public messaging really matters. So that when we treat them as legitimate warriors and soldiers, that's just not good.
But wouldn't a civilian trial just give Al-Qaeda members more of an opportunity to make speeches and grandstands, perhaps speeches that will be picked up and disseminated throughout the world?
I know. I think that's a fair argument, but I also think that, you know, judges and courts have a lot of leeway in preventing that from happening. I mean, if you look back at, you know, what was done with the Unabomber, that was something he was constantly trying to speechify. And the way the judge dealt with that problem, I mean, it really, that he wasn't able to do that. So, again, I think judges have a lot of power here to control that thing.
I don't know. I mean, I know Zachariah Massawi, I'll just identify him as the so-called 20th hijacker, but he wasn't. But that's what people still identify him with. Mm-hmm. Massawi made a lot of speeches at his trial. Do you know if they gained any currency in the Arab or the Muslim world?
I mean, certainly some people in some of the chat groups and the websites tried to make a big deal out of that. But I think at the end of the day, no matter what he said, he was treated as a criminal and he was put in jail, and he's spending the rest of his life in jail as a criminal. So as many people would have loved to treat him as a martyr to the cause. But, you know, he's the fact is, and people look at him now, he's just a common criminal in jail with a bunch of other common criminals.
Now, back to the issue of the Cheneys, the attacking Cheneys and the attack of the Cheneys. What's your assessment of how the media has treated or responded to Liz Cheney as she's tried to make herself a public intellectual or at least a person who's quoted a lot?
You know, well, the media loves when people fight, and they love when people attack each other, and they can report on that. So I think she's shown a real intelligence in understanding how the media works and the sort of things that the media are going to want to cover. I mean, if you remember the initial flurry of coverage that she got, she seemed to be on all the channels all the time, doing a number of very, very accommodating interviews that helped to establish her as this credible voice. I mean, I think, again, she's just been very intelligent about the way she's gone about this, and it does speak to the inability of our media, I think, to really hold these people accountable and to really use language, you know, the appropriate language to communicate the depth and scope of the policy failure that took place under these people.
Do you think her actions and her words should essentially disqualify her from being, say, a participant on a talk show panel like ABC's This Week, where they want to get the whole range of political opinion?
Yeah, I don't know if I would say disqualify, but it seems to me that when you put her up there with some of the, you know, everyone has been wrong in the past, I think. But when you put her up there espousing some of these ideas and treating her as just another talking head, I mean, I'm not, it seems like there's just something wrong with that. You know, I mean, we were able to test these ideas, you know, out in the world, unfortunately, in so many different ways. So for her to just kind of be out there with no acknowledgement that anything went wrong, it seems to me that's a real failure of our media.
Although there are many, many pundits who get a big paycheck who just have a track record of being wrong about everything. It doesn't seem to stop them.
I totally agree with that. I think the problem is certainly bigger than Liz Cheney.
Yeah. And now here's an interesting poll. They asked people, New York Times and CBS, about the favorability of Dick Cheney, and 41% of Americans viewed him favorably. 57% have an unfavorable opinion of him. I wouldn't like my popularity figures to be that, but for Cheney, it's pretty good, right? Isn't he rising in the favorability ratings?
Oh, right. For Dick Cheney, that's very, very impressive.
And what do you attribute this rise? Is it just that we have short memories?
Well, I think, you know, this is often the case, you know, after even for George W. Bush, whose approval ratings are creeping back up, there's a sort of nostalgia that sets back in. It always seems to be better back then. But I think the fact that he's still down where he is says a lot about Dick Cheney. I mean, if you look at the actual opinion polls about the policies that Cheney supported, specifically the war on Iraq, there's still an overwhelming disapproval of the war, even though they've been outselling the surge as having turned the war around. Almost two-thirds of Americans still say the war wasn't worth fighting. So, I mean, I think that, you know, looking at what people think about the actual policies is useful as well.
What do you expect to come from his memoirs?
I don't know. I mean, we could see some serious score settling. I think what we'll see, given the role that Liz is playing, you know, is a lot of reference to secret intelligence. I mean, this has been Cheney's, you know, MO for a long time. This, you know, even during the lead up to the war in Iraq, oh, we have secret intelligence. We know where the WMD are. I've seen certain things. I can't tell you about this, but just trust me, I'm right. So I think we'll probably see a lot of this reference to things that he knows, but he can't really go into that just shows that his ideas are correct. But certainly a lot of attack on the Obama administration. That's one thing we can be sure of.
You know, several people have pointed out that he's kind of the most active former vice president in terms of weighing in on policy in a way, in an aggressive way, in an appointed way that George Bush totally has not been. Now, do you fault him for that? Because if these are his views, you indicated that he honestly holds these views. They're a view that America is getting less safe, so that's a pretty serious view. Shouldn't he have the opportunity? Of course, he's the vice president. He's going to be given a forum just because he's so famous and was once so important. So do you criticize him for how he's conducted himself in his post-vice presidency and the attention given to him?
Well, I, you know, he certainly is, you know, a free citizen to his freedom of speech to say whatever he wants. But I think he has shown a tendency to really come out with these accusations that are simply born, these attacks on the Obama administration for making us less safe, these assertions that torture prevented more terrorist attacks, which is simply not borne out by the evidence that we have. He makes these charges, and again, I think that's probably not appropriate, but I also think it's what's not appropriate is the failure of the media to really push back hard enough on this.
And what of Liz Cheney? I think your article indicates that some people talk that she may want to run for office someday.
Right. I mean, one of the main funders of Keep America Safe, a man named Mel Sembler, who was a big Republican fundraiser. He was former finance chair of the Republican National Committee, has made a lot of noise about Liz running either from Virginia or from her home, the Cheney's home state of Wyoming. So it's the general, among the people I spoke to for the article, the general understanding was that, yes, she does hope at some point to run for office.
So. Well, joining us from Virginia, which may be Liz Cheney's future stomping grounds, is Matthew Duss. He's the national security editor for the blogs Think Progress in the Wonk Room. We're talking about Attack of the Cheneys in the April 5th edition of The Nation. Matthew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.